You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Things aren't easy in Rome in the 50s. It was a diverse and cosmopolitan city that was facing rising political instability, cultural tension, and growing social unrest across the board. Emperor Nero began his tumultuous reign, and the elite were increasingly isolated from the masses, and the strain was showing, exacerbated by the increasing concentration of wealth in the hands of a few. Political corruption was widespread, and the transactional client-patron system continued to reinforce social and economic inequalities. The working poor, not paid enough to get along, relied heavily on grain distribution programs from the state. And any disruption in these programs led to unrest. Sound familiar? The people of the Way, unlikely to have even been called Christians yet, were considered a Jewish sect, and tension was rife within the movement between Gentile converts and Jewish believers who saw the non-Jewish Jesus followers as usurpers, threatening long-established religious norms. Broader cultural shifts in the empire were setting the stage for even more upheavals, including the marginalization and persecution of both Jews and Christians. And who is crazy enough to enter this fray with his understanding of how to work it all out? Paul. Now remember, the author of Romans is the original Paul, not the misogynist, Roman-accommodating, fake Paul of the later letters. He's essentially a stranger writing to a community that is already squabbling and likely to have heard different rumors about Paul and his motives. So, today's passage has Paul offering a carrot of encouragement. He acknowledges that he understands that things aren't great. There are persecutions and hardship and sufferings, but he says, don't give up. He uses a birth metaphor and says, hey, it's not just your struggles. The whole of creation is groaning for liberation from this present craziness. He then emphasizes how we're all in this together, Jews, Gentiles, and all of creation, and how if there's any hope for the future, it depends on everyone leading lives that have been transformed to work together in achieving the kind of future that will make the present hardships fade from memory.
Our words of wisdom are from Romans chapter 8, verses 18 through 25.
I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory about to be revealed to us.
For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God.
We know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now, and not only the creation, but ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly while we wait for adoption, the redemption of our bodies.
For in hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what is seen? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Mullah Nasruddin was on his first ocean voyage and was deathly ill. Trying to comfort him, the steward said, "Don't be so downhearted, sir. I've never heard of anyone dying of seasickness. Don't tell me that, moaned Nasruddin. The only thing that is keeping me alive is the hope that I might die soon. Can you relate? Just kill me now. I mean, sometimes I feel like I'm a subject in one of those horrible Kurt Richter experiments in the 1950s. A professor at Johns Hopkins, Richter conducted now infamous studies on rats as a psychology experiment. Rats were placed in buckets of water and forced to swim until they grew exhausted and drowned, on average, just a few minutes. The second set of experiments was exactly like the first, except just when a rat got too exhausted to swim any longer, Richter would remove it for a few seconds and dry it off before putting it back in the water to keep swimming. These rats managed to swim for 7 whole minutes before drowning. The conclusion? That rats in the second group swam longer because they had what was essentially the rodent equivalent of hope. They'd experienced a rescue, and what kept them going longer was the hope, as irrational as it might seem, that they would be rescued again. Who knew this kind of rat race would become so literal in our lives? I don't know about you, but over the course of the last 6 months, I've been swimming hard. And sometimes I'm convinced we're not going to make it. That too much is being done and undone, all with gleeful cruelty to even bother going on. But I have managed to keep going. Call it naive, but I just can't believe that the future seeming to unfold before us is what's meant to be. I'm too marinated in the vision Jesus has set before us to give up. I've seen glimpses of what's possible. But the sad truth is that it's dangerous to be optimistic, to resist, and to hope. Why? Because all those behaviors make a person vulnerable. If you don't look out, you might be disappointed, be hurt, or look stupid. For a lot of people, it seems that the fear of being disappointed far outweighs the promise of hoping in something. So the choice is to hunker down and lower one's expectations. But in our passage today, Paul is encouraging people with some basic observations. Look, he says, the whole cosmos is about struggle. It's about revealing something better, despite the odds. In fact, because of the odds, disciples have come to know this thing called hope. And as we've heard, it's not unique to Christians. Even rats can hope. So, what's your excuse? What keeps you going? Is it the ability you have to see injustice being done? Your capacity to embrace what could and should be and lift up prophetic words and actions? Is it the gift of being able to be dissatisfied and disappointed with the way the world is? Look at your life. We, by nature, swing between disappointment and hope and dissatisfaction and contentment and struggle and ease. And all those things are good. Harry Emerson Fosdick once quipped, "Rocks and trees can't be disappointed. Only human beings can." The farther down in the scale of existence we go, the less disappointment is possible. The farther up we rise, the more disappointment is probable. But even though a tree can't be disappointed in the same conscious way we can, Paul suggests all of creation is giving birth to something new. And we're called to be a part of it. We've got a hint. We've felt the joy. We've had a glimmer. And that's what gives us the endurance, the hope to go on. In the meantime, we're not called to throw a tantrum, but to do our part in the unfolding of Jesus' vision for a world where compassion, justice, and kindness are the order of the day. You probably know that one of Disney's signature mottos for its theme parks is "the happiest place on earth." And that's really saying something, especially because many of them have to compete with the reality of being located in the United States. But in reality, the location of the actual happiest place on earth has gone back and forth for years. Who sits at the top of the heap as the happiest place on earth? For 2025 and for the 8th consecutive year, Finland, followed by Denmark, Iceland, and Sweden. This year, Costa Rica and Mexico, yes, Mexico, have broken into the top 10. But hang on, where's the U.S. in the index? For 2025, we've officially dropped to our lowest ever rank, 24th, behind Germany and the U.K. The fact is that the Nordic countries continue to lead the world in every objective metric used to measure what might otherwise seem to be a subjective attribute, that of happiness. And what are those attributes? Institutions and communities that are committed collectively to prioritizing compassion, justice, and kindness. Due to their strong social systems of universal health care, education, and support in time of need, they not only have a longer, healthier life expectancy, they have more personal autonomy to make life choices, unfettered by lack of resources. They emphasize charitable giving, volunteerism, and helping strangers. And through public policies of transparency and accountability, they have high levels of trust in their public institutions. But all of that only accounts for 3/4 of the indicators. A full 25% of the score is calculated on kindness and trust. An expectation of things as simple as people helping strangers or returning lost wallets, all of which play an outsized role in explaining people's overall sense of well-being. And guess what? With an increased commitment to stronger social systems, be it welfare, health, or educational opportunities, nations like the aforementioned Costa Rica and Mexico continue to climb up the happiness index. Meanwhile, between Elon's chainsaw, Doge's cuts, the demonization of diversity, equity, and inclusion, the current administration's commitment to weakening our social safety net, and the celebration of all things white Christian nationalist, the U.S.'s decline, Rome-like, continues to accelerate. Add to that the general mistrust of others, the cruelty meted out to immigrants and our LGBTQ neighbors, and a rise in isolated, solitary lifestyles. And is there any glimmer of hope? Yes. The pain, the disappointments, is not where we're intended to stay. Paul acknowledges that all of creation is groaning inwardly with the pains of new birth, with anticipation. And Paul is no dummy. His use of the metaphor of birth resonates deeply with us as human beings. Who hasn't heard about or experienced personally a young mother in the throes of labor, crying out in pain, asking if all this pain is worth it? But it remains one of the deeply primal truths of the human experience that we know at our core that such suffering is temporary and what comes next is worth the struggle. And any of us, all of us, who expect anything out of life, who expect for Jesus' vision to be lived out through us, know that we are going to experience disappointment, pain, and uncertainty. We groan about those pains and disappointments. But Paul reminds the Romans and us to not ignore the glimmer of hope within each of us that is part of all creation, bringing to reality what God wills for the world. On the strength of what we know already and continue to experience, we can anticipate something of what being a part of the new creation will be like, and know that whatever we face, an unwavering commitment to crazy, naive ideas like compassion, kindness, and justice are not that crazy at all. But here's the rub. Paul's final argument is that the very thing that fuels hope is that it is unrealized. There is no virtue in hoping for something that is easily grasped. Hope is about that which is just beyond our reach. And as efforts continue to try to erase LGBTQ plus protections, silence marginalized voices, censor educational materials, defund inclusive institutions, constrain judicial oversight, detain and abuse immigrants, and seeing once robust civil rights protections whittled away, there are lots of causes seeming to slip just beyond our reach. But one thing the proponents of exclusion, cruelty, and injustice haven't counted on is that we are some pretty determined rats, committed to not drown alone, but to work together, even in seemingly insignificant acts of risky, compassionate, graceful living. As Rabbi Harold Kushner reminds us, through grace, suffering makes compassion possible. And what is more central to the life of faith than striving to be more compassionate? And that's where hope flourishes, in a positive feedback loop of small acts of compassion, hope, small acts of kindness, hope, small acts of resistance, hope, and yes, with a whole lot of groaning along the way. Friends, now more than ever, we need to remind ourselves that sometimes it doesn't take much to change a life, to change a community, to change the world. The hope of one person held close, nurtured through thick and thin, can be enough. And our numbers are growing. There's a whole lot of groaning going on, but we can't let that overwhelm us with despair or anxiety or with thoughts that all is lost. Even in the throes of situations most of us are having difficulty imagining would ever be a reality, we need to remind one another that we are part of the work, part of the labor, with all its pain, of giving birth to something new in the world. Let me wrap it up by suggesting a pretty simple spiritual practice that, in the midst of all the setbacks and the groaning, has been helpful to me. Don't lose touch with gratitude. You've probably heard people recommend keeping a gratitude journal or some other high commitment exercise I'm not inclined to follow through on. Instead, when I'm laying in bed at night, catastrophizing, I take a few deep breaths and instead reflect on one thing, one person, or one development for which or for whom I'm grateful. Shifting my focus away from how helpless I feel or how furious I am over the cruelty du jour, I'm able to create a small space for hope to seep in. Yeah? Look, here's this real person, this real change, this real effort that may not be earth-shattering in its impact, but is a touchstone with what is possible. And in that moment of gratitude for whatever that is, everything else is pushed aside, if even for a moment, by the undeniable, unwavering, tenacious presence of hope. Just enough to convince myself that I can keep on swimming one more day. Be well. Don't forget, if you liked what you heard today, buy me a coffee. The link's in the description.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.